Oh no, I'm going to not stand on the box because Carlo Del Ponte is a bit short, so I won't stand on the box. I'm standing beside. Well, first of all, I want to welcome everybody. We are incredibly lucky to have today Carlo Del Ponte, not simply because she's prosecutor for the Hague Tribunal, and the Hague Tribunal on the former Yugoslavia is very, very important, and that's one reason why it's important that she's here. I mean, I think it's not just important for Yugoslavia, it's really important for the whole of the development of international law, for all those who want to see a world governed by international law, but also because the prosecutor's role is so key. It really requires a very active person like Carlo Del Ponte to make the Hague Tribunal really an effective institution. It really does depend at this stage in the development of international law on somebody really active and courageous. And she is a very active and courageous person. Before she became prosecutor, she was fighting organized crime in Switzerland and bank secrecy, and she hasn't hesitated to take on the most powerful people, not just Milosevic, but all kinds of people she's had to prosecute. And she survived at least one assassination attempt. So this is a really brave and courageous role that she plays. And so that's why I think it's so important for us to hear what she has to say. Just to give you an example of how she is regarded, recently there was a football match in Bosnia between the Republika Srpska and the Federation. And the Serb football fans were shouting, "Knife, wire, Srebrenica," in order to taunt the Muslims on the other side. And apparently this rhymes in Serbo-Croat. But in reply, the Muslims were chanting, "Carlo Del Ponte." So that really gives you an idea of what a heroine she is for many people. Now, just a couple of, a few little announcements. First of all, this is a lecture for both our Balkan program, a program we have for faculty development in the whole of the Balkans, which links universities in the Balkans, and our Global Civil Society program, because if there is to be a Global Civil Society, it does depend on the development of international law. Second announcement is that her whole speech will be on our website tomorrow. So if you want to read her speech, if you want to refer to it in essays, you can look up on our website, which is LSE, I don't know if it's up there, no it's not, .ac.uk/depths for department slash global. Second announcement, she'll talk for about 40, 45 minutes, and there will be time for questions, but I'm taking questions, not statements, not comments. So as my former boss, Meghnad Desai, always said, I will only take an intervention if it starts with, does the speaker think? Or what does the speaker say to this? And finally, when the whole thing finishes, and I'll remind you when we come to an end, if you just let me and Carlo Del Ponte go out first before you all move, I'd be very grateful. So without any more ado, please let me introduce our illustrious speaker.
Good evening, everybody. I don't know, I'm not comfortable.
It's okay.
You can
stand there. That's fine. Press going down. That's it.
A little bit. So I'm not so short.
No, you're not. Is it too tall for you? Shall we take
that's
it
fine.
Away?
Yes.
Would you be happier without it?
A little bit higher.
What, the lecture?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
Right, goes down slightly, goes up.
But you know, it is extremely important that I can read because my English is not. I'm not.
I think that's as high as it goes, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Well, should we put it down and take the box away?
What do you think? Take the box away. We can bring the lectern down. That's right.
Yeah.
Is that better?
Thank you very much for your kind introduction, Professor Kaldor, and also for the invitation to speak here at the London School of Economics. I am particularly proud. As the prosecutor of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, and as the former prosecutor, unfortunately former prosecutor, for the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, it is a great pleasure for me to present my views on the role of international criminal prosecution in reconstructing divided communities. Indeed, I consider this role fundamental, yet I know that it is extremely difficult to assess it. At the outset, I would like to clarify the scope of my presentation. Speaking about international criminal prosecutions, I'm limiting myself to the crimes which form the subject matter jurisdiction of the UN ad hoc criminal tribunals and of the International Criminal Court, namely war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide. While the categories of war crimes are relatively well known and defined, we may define for the purpose of clarity crimes against humanity as a crime committed as part of an attack against a civilian population, and genocide as a crime committed with the intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group. By way of introduction, I would like to highlight the fact that often we face contradictory pressures between justice on the one hand and the need to restore peace and stability in conflict-shattered countries on the other. Some assert that without justice, there is no peace, or at least no lasting peace. But others claim that insisting on bringing the person responsible for the crimes before justice may delay or even block the peace process and thus impose further suffering to the population concerned. Of course, the title of my presentation, The Role of International Criminal Prosecutions in Reconstructing Divided Communities, already assumes that the justice path is chosen. This assumption brings to light yet other difficult choices. Even though it is decided to make people accountable for their crimes, different solutions can be envisaged. Truth and Reconciliation Commission, sometimes combined with a partial amnesty, fully fledged prosecutions by national courts, or, of course, international prosecutions. Hence, a legitimate question: should international prosecutions be favored over national prosecutions? Isn't it important that the crimes be tried as closely as possible to the place where they were committed and where the victims live? Should the trials take place at the international level to provide guarantees of independence and impartiality? There are no easy answers to any of these questions, but I would like you to consider. First, often divided societies and countries lack the will or the power to prosecute and try those responsible for the worst crimes, in particular their leaders. Second, even when they establish prosecutions and trial, domestic courts in divided societies often do not provide the necessary guarantees for a due process of justice. Indeed, the paraphrase, a saying dear to lawyers, justice must not only be fair, but must also be seen to be fair. On this basis, I strongly believe that widespread and systematic crimes, as they were, for instance, committed in the former Yugoslavia, in Rwanda, in Sierra Leone, or in East Timor, to take but a few of the most recent examples warrant an international intervention in the form of international prosecutions. This said, the very concept of instituting international criminal prosecutions is rather recent. Mass killings took place throughout history, from the Roman destruction of Carthage to the most recent massacre in the Democratic Republic of Congo, through the crimes committed against the native Indian American peoples and the massacre in Cambodia under the Pol Pot regime. Scottish writer Jill Elliott remarked 30 years ago when he published the 20th century Book of the Dead that in the 20th century the number of men met death is about 100 million. Still, it has often been noted that until recently one stood a much better chance of being tried for the murder of one person than the massacre of thousands. Indeed, after the First World War and the unsuccessful attempt to try German and Turkish war criminals provided for in the Treaty of Versailles of 1919 and the Treaty of Sèvres of 1920, it was only in 1945 that the very first international criminal jurisdiction was established in Nuremberg. On 8 August 1945, the Allies concluded in this city, London, an agreement establishing the International Military Tribunal, mandated to try the most notorious German responsible for crimes against peace, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. In the Nuremberg trial, 22 accused were tried and convicted in 10 months, largely because of the documentary evidence that was available to the prosecutors and judges. The creation of the Nuremberg trial and the judgment it rendered provided the foundation for all subsequent international criminal proceedings. In its judgment, the Nuremberg trial recognized that crimes against international law are committed by men, not by abstract entities, and only by punishing individuals who committed such crime can the provisions of international law be enforced. The following year, on 19 January 1946, the Tokyo Charter established the International Military Tribunal for the Far East. Despite the criticism levied to the Nuremberg and Tokyo tribunals, notably for being victor justice, they were an essential step in the evolution of the principle of international criminal prosecutions. Once the work of these two jurisdictions was over, little progress was subsequently made at the international level to punish any crimes against humanity, war crimes, and other mass atrocities. Some had hoped that the international military tribunals would lead to the establishment of a permanent international criminal court operating on the basis of an international criminal code, but the reality of the international relations during the Cold War period manifested itself in blocking any such effort. It was only after the shocking crimes committed during the disintegration of the former Yugoslavia that the international community established another international criminal tribunal in 1993. The International Criminal Tribunal for the Former Yugoslavia, or ICTY, was established by the UN Security Council, acting on the basis of its power under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter. The Security Council found that serious violations of international humanitarian law constituted a threat to the international peace and security, and it considered that the prosecution of persons responsible for these violations would contribute to the process of national reconciliation and to restoration and maintenance of peace. When in 1994, At the very least, 500,000 persons were killed in Rwanda. The Security Council was pushed to act again, as it had done before the former Yugoslavia. Rwanda officially requested the creation of an international jurisdiction, as its domestic judicial system had been destroyed. The killing of lawyers, prosecutors, and judges, and the fleeing from Rwanda of many others had left the country's legal system unable to cope with the tens of thousands of cases generated by the genocide. Additionally, several UN reports expose the scale of the massacres committed and called for those responsible to be brought to justice. The UN Security Council decided to establish the Ad Hoc International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, or ICTR, to promote justice and reconciliation in this country. Almost 2 years after the establishment of the ICTY, the Security Council reiterated its position that serious violation of international humanitarian law constitute a threat to international peace and security. Creating this jurisdiction was obviously a giant step, but everything remained to be done. For these tribunals to be credible, they needed first and foremost to actually try cases, and second, to operate fairly and provide due process of justice. As was expressed by Justice Robert Jackson, the US Chief Prosecutor at Nuremberg, the task ahead was to patiently and temperately disclose the record of terrible crimes. My predecessors, as myself, have tried and continue to try to do just that. Justice must be done. However, an international tribunal cannot investigate every violation that has occurred in the course of several years. We are simply unable to investigate each and every case of torture, rape, or even murder. There are too many victims and too many criminals. Moreover, our mandate is limited to war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. In this context, we have focused our efforts on the most atrocious and heinous crimes, and we also concentrate our prosecutions on the main perpetrators or the architects of these crimes. I arrived at The Hague as chief prosecutor of the ICTY and the ICTR in September of 1999. At this time, the war in Kosovo was coming to an end. Although the ICTY had existed for some 5 years, it was still in many ways just beginning. At that point, the bulk of our work had involved investigations. Only 13 trials had begun, and only the Tadic case had made it all the way through the trial and appeal process. It has been a busy 4 years for us. We have indicted 34 individuals, plus another 60 indictments in an amended version. We have completed 16 first instance trials, and the appeals chamber has rendered 8 judgments. Moreover, 51 accused have been arrested or surrendered voluntarily and have been transferred to our detention center in The Hague. So far, 92 accused have already appeared in proceedings before the ICTY. As for the future, realizing that the states would only continue to support our efforts if we could show that we are maximizing our activities, we have embarked into a so-called completion strategy. It foresees that we will terminate all investigations by the end of 2004. As a consequence, we now concentrate on a small number of very high-level persons suspected of being responsible for the most serious crimes. The Security Council, the UN Security Council, recently endorsed this strategy in its resolution 5003, and I expect approximately 30 additional suspects to be indicted before the end of my investigation. This could result up to 13 new indictments and 9 trials concerning all the main communities in the region. To date, 21 indictees remain at large, including General Ratko Mladic, believed to be in Serbia, Radovan Karadzic, believed to be in Republika Srpska, and General Ante Gotovina, believed to be in Croatia. Nonetheless, we have been successful in apprehending some of the highest level leaders responsible for the terrible events that took place in the former Yugoslavia. The most famous example of our success is obviously, you know, the arrest and trial of Slobodan Milosevic. As you know, his trial is still underway, slowed down due to his ill health. The ICTY has completed a number of significant cases against key persons responsible for atrocities. To take a recent example, on 31st July, one of the trial chamber in The Hague passed the first lifelong imprisonment in the tribunal's history. Dr. Milomir Stakic, the leading politician in the northeastern Bosnia town of Prijedor, was held responsible for a brutal campaign of ethnic cleansing that led to death, detention, and deportation of thousands of Bosnian Muslims. In particular, Stakic was found responsible for the establishment of the Omarska, Kera Term, and Tropolje camps. You may recall having seen in 1992 the images of emaciated men looking through barbed wires into the cameras of international media. Ethnic cleansing, or persecution as we call it, is a crime against humanity and constitutes one of the most extreme forms of human rights violations. It forms the core of what happened in the 90s in the former Yugoslavia. In the name of extreme national, racial, ethnic, or religious policies, people were expelled from their jobs, raped, tortured, deported, detained, and killed, and that just because they did not belong to the right group as defined by the perpetrators. Furthermore, the ICTY has developed its jurisprudence on crimes specifically targeting women. In the Celebici case, rape was recognized as constituting a form of torture under international law. In the Kunaraj case, the ICTY found 2 of the accused guilty inter alia of rape as a crime against humanity and a violation of the laws or customs of war. This case concerned the rape and enslavement of women and girls and instances where women were loaned among the men, traded, and even sold. Many victims, some of them 12 years old girls, were detained in homes, schools, and gyms, and gang raped publicly. The enslavement of the women lasted for days, sometimes for months. Recent decisions have also shed light on an important area for international prosecutions: the issue of command responsibility. Several judgments have confirmed that regardless of the function of a superior, be it not only a military but also a politician, a teacher, or a philosopher, if or she did have subordinates and command authority over them, he or she is criminally responsible for their crimes if he or she failed to stop them or to punish them. A superior cannot turn a blind eye towards what is happening in his or her area of responsibility, but has to take action if information in his or her possession looks suspicious, if not alarming, as determined in the recent appeals decision in the Kroneljak case. It held that the accused, a warden in a Foča camp, had a concrete duty to investigate the acts of his subordinates, even if he did not have a direct knowledge of the crimes they were committing. When he saw blood and bullet holes on the walls of the camp. Now, of course, our work becomes particularly relevant as it exposes to the world in general, and in particular to the people directly concerned in the former Yugoslavia, the crimes committed. Therefore, it is crucial that we ensure that our judgments reach the communities involved, and in particular, the victims. In this regard, my office works closely with the ICTY registrar to ensure that a full public explanation is provided and available in the former Yugoslavia to all interested parties, and in particular to the victims of the crimes. I believe that the needs and the longing that victims have for justice was magnificently expressed by a witness who appeared before the ICTY. This witness, Teufika Ibrahim Efendic, a psychologist from Bosnia, testified in the trial of General Radislav Krstić, who was charged with the massacres committed in Srebrenica in July 1995. In her testimony, Mrs. Ibrahim Efendic talked about the trauma of the surviving women and children of Srebrenica. I quote, "At that time, the greatest and most stressful traumatic event for them was the disappearance of a large number of men, heads of families, fathers, brothers, uncles, and so on, so that every woman had losses. All the women I worked with had lost 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 persons. A woman I worked with, 56 male members of her immediate and broader family went missing in a single day. So the search for the missing, what happened to them? Were they killed? If they were killed, were they tortured? How were they killed? Were they wounded? Were they hungry, thirsty? Where their bones are, the digging up of graves, identification of victims. All these are additionally stressful events, additionally traumas that traumatize them on a daily basis. The fact that they do not know the truth, even the worst truth, would be better for them than this uncertainty, this constant, perpetual uncertainty as to what happened to their loved ones, because they keep waiting, they are waiting for something. They cannot begin life, they cannot face up with the reality of the death of a missing person. They only remember the moment they bade farewell, the moment when they have agreed to meet in a spot that would be safe. And this is still something that still guides them in their thoughts." End of quote. At the end of her testimony, the presiding judge asked the witnesses what she saw at the role of International Tribunal in The Hague. She answered, and I quote again, "The Hague Tribunal, all the victims, all the women with whom I have had a chance to work, was a very great significance for them. They expect that justice will be done. We believed we were members of a civilized society, of a society where good will be compensated for and evil punished. They do trust that the real causes of what happened will be identified and that the people will muster enough courage, including victims, to tell the story of what happened. Those who did it, that they too will be able to speak out so that we all can have a future, so that we all can have a basis for a common life together one day. Great expectations are being placed upon the tribunal. People expect that justice will be done and that the right decisions will be reached." End of quote. This witness expressed in her own words, I believe, some of the important roles that the international prosecutions must play. Record what really happened and make the persons responsible accountable. The truth-telling component of international prosecutions is extremely important. To some extent, a historical record emerged and people are forced to face up to the crimes committed or ordered by their own leaders. But of course, this role is somehow restricted by the very limits that we face in our international prosecutions and that I was exposing to you earlier. We can only prosecute so many crimes and must concentrate our efforts on the leaders whenever we can bring them to trial. Therefore, I wonder whether truth and reconciliation commissions do not sometimes provide a better historical record of the crimes committed. But at the same time, as a prosecutor for more than 20 years, I'm deeply convinced that holding people accountable for their crimes is of paramount importance, especially for the categories of crimes we are referring to now. In any case, truth commission also have many potential pitfalls, notably the risk of politicization of the process, question of confidentiality of the results, and of course, issues of amnesty. Truth commission can nonetheless play their part. A specific model must be designed on a case-by-case approach, specifically for the country concerned, and if possible, in complement to a prosecution process. The other important function of prosecution is to emphasize individual criminal responsibility and to break down the idea of collective guilt and demonization of whole groups. I would like to take the example of the ICTR to illustrate this idea. After the crimes committed in Rwanda in 1994, it was clear that a transformation of values among the Rwandan people was needed. Most have been subjected to decades of incitement of ethnic hatred and violence, whether as victims or as obedient perpetrators. The Tutsi have to absolve the Hutu of indefinite collective responsibility for the genocide, while also having a legitimate means of vindicating their suffering. Generally, the ICTR, as well as national tribunals, have a decisive role to play in that respect. Justice has to be done so that the vicious cycle of impunity is broken and that collective vengeance against Hutu as well as against Tutsi is definitely discouraged. The prosecution of all those suspected of having organized massacres, irrespective of their ethnic identity, it is a crucial confidence-building measure that would greatly contribute to the peace in Rwanda and consequently to the long-term stability of the entire Great Lakes region. At this juncture, it is important to underline that international criminal jurisdiction can and should, whenever possible, interact with national judicial system in various ways. Although we have primacy, and although we may have doubts about the quality of justice provided by the domestic courts, we have to work in partnership with the international jurisdictions. We cannot prosecute all cases, and therefore we must, I believe, set an example to damaged legal system and help them without our limits and as long as they want our help. We tried to do just that with Rwanda when I held the mandate of ICTR prosecutor. Let me also take the example of the ICTY and of the Rules of the Road project that we developed to assist the Bosnian prosecutors. They submit to us their files when they wish to bring war crimes charges. This is a good example of our activities, slightly outside our core mandate, but very much consistent with it. ICTY thus provides an important safeguard against arbitrary arrest and directly helps to build confidence among people and to reconstruct a multi-ethnic society. International prosecutions, by recording the crimes which took place, setting what really happened, and making the person responsible accountable for these crimes, also deter the commission of similar crimes. I believe that this is yet another role for international prosecutions. Of course, the deterrence of crimes is difficult to assess, and it is never complete. The prosecutions of murder for centuries by our respective domestic judicial system have never put an end to their commission. But still, deterrence, especially at the international level, should not be overlooked. It is reported that Adolf Hitler remarked in the late 1930s, "Who remembers the Armenians?" If it is correct, it illustrates the deterrent role that international prosecutions could play if only they could one day be universal and would suffer no exception. To conclude, the basic point to be made is that an essential precondition for reconciliation is the removal from the scene of high-level war criminals, so that the influence cannot continue in the post-conflict arrangements. Justice makes this unique contribution to the reconstruction of divided societies. Of course, there are no easy answers to the contradictory pressures of justice and pacification in restoring stability to divided communities. Last month, the United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan called for more resources and greater effort to enhance the rule of law in the course of UN peacekeeping operations. He stressed that people lose faith in the peace process in the face of impunity for past grievous crimes and without a restoration of justice in rebuilding shattered societies. He said, "Ending the climate of impunity is vital to restoring public confidence and building international support to implement peace agreements. There should be no amnesties for war crimes, genocide, crimes against humanity, or other serious violation of international humanitarian rights," he added. Yet the relentless pursuit of justice may sometimes be an obstacle to peace. If we insist at all times and in all places on punishing those who are guilty of extreme violations of human rights, it may be difficult or even impossible to stop the bloodshed and save innocent civilians. If we always and everywhere insist on uncompromising standards of justice, a delicate peace may not survive. The Secretary General concluded, "We have learned that the rules of law delayed is lasting peace denied, and that justice is the handmaiden of true peace. Implementing this lesson is a tremendous challenge. Removing the bad apples from the barrel may, in the short term, complicate efforts to hold a fragile peace together. But in the long run, the alternative is to store up trouble for the future and to sow the seeds for future conflict. There is no lasting or sustainable peace without facing up to massive crimes when they have been committed. This seems to be now generally accepted by policymakers. Peace and justice are complementary. Dreadful events of history repeat themselves, and the ever present threats to civilization seem to take a new and frightening forms. We must therefore do everything we can to redress the balance and to promote the values upon which society itself rests. The future will not build itself if we sit by passively and watch. If the peoples of the world are to secure the continuity of their diverse cultural, linguistic, national, and ethnic group, we must invest in the future, and we must strive to insist the necessary values in succeeding generations. Failure to comply with the norms of international law, in my experience, always leads to the radicalization of confrontations. Thus, impunity is an aggravating factor in a conflict. I would like to finish by citing my friend Benjamin Ferencz, who was one of the young American prosecutors involved in the work of the Nuremberg Tribunal and remained today a strong and vocal supporter of international criminal justice. He recently said, "Nations should recognize that a more peaceful and human world can only come about by replacing the force of war by the force of law. Small and poor nations have much more at stake than the rich and powerful. In our interdependent planet, the peace and well-being of each is inextricably linked to the peace and well-being of all. Outdated notions of sovereignty must not block acceptance of rules of the road needed to enhance the security of the people everywhere by deterring wars of aggression, genocide, and the horrible crimes against humanity that continue to deface the human landscape. The world is filled with human suffering, but it also blessed by very many people who are determined to make it a better place for all and whose individual efforts made a difference. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for a very moving and inspiring lecture. We now have about half an hour for questions. So what I'd ask you to, as I said before, I want a question, and I'd like it if you'd say your name and where you're from. And I'll take that gentleman from the balcony first, because the balcony always gets forgotten about.
Hi, Dr. Cecilia Hoza from Kosovo. You mentioned the end of this investigation is going to be in 2004. What will happen with the rest of the criminals that they will still hide in Serbia? And are you confident enough that Serbian government will persecute them? Is there any chance that these criminals would be persecuted in Kosovo, in future independent of Kosovo?
Our investigation by the end of 2004, but it is also for sure that we are against impunity, and it is also sure that we have many evidences against other suspects that we cannot investigate or put in trial in The Hague. So the problem is it possible that the domestic court are able to conduct a fair trial, or even to finish the investigations and to have the perpetrators in trial. It is different to see. You are asking about Serbia, Serbia-Montenegro. Serbia-Montenegro, they passed a new law about war crimes, and they decide to have a special prosecutor for war crimes. So they manifest the goodwill to do it. Of course, they have a lot of difficulties to conduct a fair trial. As you know, they dismiss many judges, and they are now trying to have other judges, new judges. I think we must follow very closely that they are trying to have all these perpetrators in trial. Following very closely, that means to observe what they are doing, to help the domestic courts, to assist the domestic courts, and to share information with the local authorities. I think it is possible. Not only Serbia, but also Croatia and Bosnia and Herzegovina need a great help from the international community. But I think, in my experience, that the moment that the domestic courts are able to handle these cases, reconciliation and peace is achieved, not to be.
Okay, James Gow. Oops.
That's a good start. James Gow, King's College, London. I have one question with three parts to it, so just...
No,
let's put it, they're all short. Taking note of the chair's comments about football matches at the beginning and your own comments about being seen to be fair and about the political purpose of the judicial process, how far would you agree that diplomacy is among the most important elements of the prosecutor's role? How far would you agree that diplomacy is among the most
important
elements of the role? And in that context, is it sometimes counterproductive to be allowed to be reported saying you know where General Mladic is, which maybe some other people do as well, because it's not likely to make anybody be in a position to secure his person in the Hague? And the final part of that is following the death of President Izet Begovic, is it likely that he might be associated with some indictments in the future in the way that President Tudjman was after his death?
So first question about diplomacy. So it's not an element for a prosecutor to be diplomat, even the contrary. But you are right. We are confronted with politics each time. And we are trying to keep politics out of our work and not coming on our table, but it's difficult. But we are managing more or less to do it. So diplomacy, no diplomacy. I have enough difficulties to achieve the investigation, to issue the indictment, to have the confirmation. Can you imagine that I take care of the political situation in the countries? No, I cannot. Because I remember in 4 years, each time I have an election, I have a political issue who impede to execute the arrest warrant. So I'm simply transmitting the arrest warrant and expecting the arrest and the transfer. Of course, I have a tracking team. So tracking team, there are 4 or 5 investigators who are specialized in locating fugitives, because in his work activity as police in the national system, they have done that, so they know how to do it. And they are operating in the fields. Of course, when I collect a lot of information from different sources, I verify my information, I can do nothing myself, because it's not like a national prosecutor who have the judiciary police, who can send the police to look for the accused. So my only way to use the information I have is to pass this information, to the local authorities, to the national authorities. When I don't receive feedbacks, when I don't achieve to obtain the arrest, I get public. That is my leverage is first to inform the governments to obtain the arrest, and if after months, after years, because Karadzic and Mladic are at large since 8 years, so I get public, because transparency is the best way to try to obtain. The third question, I don't remember anymore.
Is it Begovic died?
Ah, it's Begovic. It's Begovic died on Sunday. what I can say is that he was under investigation by us. And so, requiescat in pace. I can only say that I need somebody of you who know Latin, so let him
rest in peace.
Rest in peace. Sorry? Unlike President Tudjman, yes. So I have just one former president in court.
Okay, you were next.
Qua.
My name is Hannes. I'm an undergrad here at the university, and I come from Austria. My question is, in the light of the quote you concluded with about the outdated notions of sovereignty, what do you think about the exclusion of certain nations from international jurisdiction, in particular the current United States administration refusal to ratify the ICC statute?
You know, of course, we will all be very satisfied if United States also join ICC, and not only United States, all states of the world, because that is a permanent court, international permanent court. But we must look at that from another side. To say important is to start. That it was possible to start with a permanent court, it is really a great achievement. Personally, I think that now we must look that this court is functioning. And I hope that the United States and other countries will not stay outside when they will see that it's not politicized, that it is proper working. So that is my hope.
Okay. I'm looking around. The lady right at the back. Is it the lady I can't see? Yes.
You can speak also Italian, French, and German. Even feel free to
Hello, my name's Jenny Pierce. I'm at UCL, but I worked for the Office of the High Representative for 5.5 years in Bosnia. Two quick questions. Firstly, with no offence to your capabilities, how confident are you that the prosecution of Milosevic is going to succeed? And the second question is that what has been the main constraint on your work? And it's best, I think, maybe to leave Karadzic and Mladic out of this, because obviously this is a huge constraint, but apart from this, the practical constraint on your work?
Milosevic trial. It's not a good question for a prosecutor, particularly for a chief prosecutor. No, but I must say that, of course, we would appreciate that we go a little bit faster in our trial. But as you know now, Milosevic have high blood pressure, though we can have only 3 days hearings in a week, commencing on Monday, but on Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday, 3 days, and only 5 hours with two or three pause. So it is really very, very slowly. But until now, I have no doubt that we will obtain the conviction of Milosevic and the sentence, of course. But we thought we could finish the presentation of the prosecution case by December, but now it will be February, after we will have 3 months to prepare the defense. So the defense case will start only in probably in summer 2004, and if he will get the same time as we get for the presentation of the prosecution case, it will be 2 years. So let's come back here in a couple of years to to tell you if the Milosevic trial is finally finished. But let me say also something else, that it is also on the system, on the procedural system we have, because it is a much more common law system. Instead, we have another system, which is called civil law system, and in 12 months we could achieve to have our Milosevic trial finished. But of course, the investigation would be much more long. But just as I said before, passionate, we will present all our evidences, and he will be able to defend himself in a most fair trial you ever seen in the world. Ah, the constraints of my work. There are so many. There are so many. No, the constraints is that I'm a prosecutor, but half of my time I'm going around in Europe, because I'm here because this morning I met with your Minister of Foreign Affairs, because I am a poor prosecutor, because I have no judiciary police, so I cannot send my police outside to obtain what I need for my investigation or for my trial. I depend entirely of the goodwill. It's called international obligation, but of the states in former Yugoslavia and on the pressure of the international community. So half of my time I'm going around in Europe. Wednesday I'm in Brussels, and after I'm just coming from the United States to ensure that is particular, and you know, it's particularly difficult because I'm a prosecutor. I like to be in my office and in court, and so I'm in court. I have no time to be in court, unfortunately, because I'm going all around to ensure, but not only the arrest, the access of witnesses, documentation. I give you an example. I was in Belgrade complaining, as usual, because I'm always complaining, and I would like to go once just to thanks for the full cooperation we received. We need documents from Croatia, Bosnia and Herzegovina, and Croatia during 91 and 96, so during the conflict. And they are denying to have access to this document. They told us, you will get this document only from 96 to 2000, only Kosovo. Yeah, why? Because I have jurisdiction about... We will not give you the access to these documents because otherwise you will prejudice our procedure by the ICG because... and you know, that is... and so we will go to the trial chamber to ask for the binding order to obtain this document. In the meantime, time is passing, and so we will lose a lot of time fighting for what is established in the law, that it is an international obligation. And that is frustrating, sometimes a lot.
The gentleman there in the yellow jacket.
Madam Carla De Ponte, in your last remark, you mentioned about the personal individual efforts to bring justice to the world. I'm sure that as an individual, your effort is more taller than almost all of us, all of our efforts.
Slowly.
As an independent impartial judge, I would like to draw your attention to the two issues. The denial of prisoner of war status to the Guantanamo detainees. What do you think about, if do you offer the POW status? Number two is that the denial of, the right equality of arms under the European human rights law. Milosevic, will he be given this equality of arms if he wanted to cross-examine so many individuals? What I mean, in the future, I wish that you bring even Saddam Hussein. He might want to cross-examine Romney. Will you allow? So, yeah, we want judges more stronger and more taller than you to so that not only the criminals, but also the other side, the superpowers also do so many war crimes. Their things go unnoticed. So the third world citizen, we want these things to be transparent.
Listen. After, we will speak in private about that. I am prosecutor from the ICTY only. I was ICTR and ICTY. I lost ICTR. So let's keep ICTY. So I cannot answer your question because I have no jurisdiction, let's say. I have no jurisdiction. It is only a personal opinion of Cara Del Ponte that is nothing. But as prosecutor from the ICTY, seriously, I have the knowledge you have, so it is just a private conversation that we can have. But please ask me about ICTY, not about the world issues, because it's
Daniel.
Daniele Archibugi, Italian National Research Council and Center for Global Governance. I loved your comment about diplomacy. I wonder, has the tribunal any competence on the war crimes committed by NATO during the 1999 war? And if not, why?
Thank you.
You know, when I arrived in 1999, I was informed by my predecessor, Louise Arbour, that she received many complaints
NATO bombing in Kosovo, and it would be obviously a political and sensitive issue. And so, like the politician, we put in place a working group. You know, when when you cannot immediately decide, even if you have that, we put in place in Switzerland. In any case, we put in place a working commission to study the problem. So, but it was a real one. It was investigators and lawyers, specialists, experts, military experts, to look at all the documents we have, to look all the complaints we receive. Because I must say we were prepared to open a formal investigation if we have the initial elements to do it. And at the end, we had a lot of meetings and discussion, and it was appreciated because I learned a lot. Because you know, it was in at the beginning of my new function, and at the end, to be able to open a formal investigation, we need a lot of information from NATO. So we prepare a request with many questions, with annexes, and then asking NATO, because that would for us so enable us to have a picture of if we can open or not an investigation. Let's make it short. I'm still expecting the answer from NATO. So we take our decision and not to open a formal investigation. And the report is public. No, absolutely not. Nothing to do with diplomacy. No, it's a technicality. Let's say that, because it was not possible to have and real. No. I refuse that absolutely.
Okay, the lady right at the back up there with the green jersey.
Svetlana Djurjevic from Belgrade, Serbia. Can you please confirm, did you ever ask late Prime Minister Djindjic, did you ever pass him an info about Mladic, and did he ever refuse to arrest him, and do you feel some kind of responsibility for his death? Thank you.
Djindjic was a great supporter of us. And I must say it was also thanks to Djindjic, to former Prime Minister Djindjic, that we could obtain the transfer of Milosevic to The Hague. He was our interlocutor. We trust him a lot because he was very sincere with us. And he told us when it was not possible something or why it was not possible something. Of course, I share with him the information I have about Mladic. I don't know if I can say it, but probably I can say it now because the poor man is no more alive. But he told me it was in February when I met him the last time. He told me, "Listen, prosecutor, I will give you Mladic in Springs." Unfortunately, 12th of March, he was killed. He explained also because it was difficult to have Mladic, but that I cannot say that. I can say that when Mladic will be arrested and transferred to The Hague. So, to tell you, Djindjic was a friend of the tribunal. And he knows that for the future of his country, it is important to cooperate with us, that all war criminals are no more active in Serbia. And unfortunately, it was also part of the assassination of Djindjic, the cooperation with us. But it was not the determination of his killing, the cooperation with us. I don't think so. It was other reasons. And himself, he explained me in this February, in this last meeting we have, he explained me what he was doing and trying to do, reform, reorganization. And during the meeting, he told me they will kill me. And so I was surprised. I said, are you joking? But we know that he was not joking, but of course he knows exactly, and he was very relaxed, and I was sure that he was enough protected not to, but that is what, just to tell you, he was a great friend of us.
The lady there.
Ivana Bajic from Belgrade. I wanted to ask you, how do you think exactly what, how is this process of reconstructing the divided communities going to take place on the territory of former Yugoslavia, whereas it is wide known in former Yugoslav republics, I mean in the first instance on Serbia, Montenegro and on Croatia, there is quite a lot of hostility towards the work of your court and what you're actually doing. I mean, you definitely know about the case that Nataša Kandić was beaten recently about, and it's not the only case like this. So I'd like to know what exactly can you tell about this reconstructed of the divided communities?
You know, we have not only opponents of our activity, we have also supporters in Serbia, in Belgrade, in Zagreb, in Sarajevo. So I think it is important to go on, because of course we are not achieving the point that we are accepted by all, because but the direction is the right direction. Even in Belgrade, it's changed a lot since the transfer of Milosevic. And important is that the local authorities and the national authorities are announcing that publicly to the people, to the population, that the cooperation with the tribunal is one of the most important issue for reconciliation. But until now, they have difficulties to do it, because they are always staying before election, and so they don't want to, of course, they don't want to lose votes. But I think that is the right direction, and it is somehow better, for example, in Croatia, with all difficulties, or even in Belgrade in some instances. But I think that is the right direction for the real reconciliation. And as I said at the end, that we are not non-existing anymore, and that the local authorities could handle these cases.
I must say that it seems to me that both the death of Djindjic and the beating up of Nataša Kandić just demonstrates how incredibly important
Yes.
the work. One couldn't possibly say we shouldn't continue with this work because people are being beaten up.
Yes.
I mean, it's precisely because one wants people to be allowed to be brave and courageous
Yes.
that this work is so important. I think we can take a couple more questions. Yes, the lady in the front here.
Bojana Todorovska from Macedonia, I'm a BBC journalist as well. A question regarding the reconstruction of divided communities. With the passing of presidents such as Izetbegović and Tudjman, just briefly going back to what you said, that Izetbegović was under investigation. As far as I'm aware, you will no longer be able to make, if you were to indict them, you can no longer make such indictments a public. Do you think that could affect reconciliation and rebuilding of these divided societies? In my view, that could have helped the truth to be made about the other side, you know, specifically
Yes.
speaking about the Federation.
Yes, it is a problem that I just discussed with my collaborators, because of course the truth, the facts is important, that it's the knowledge of what happened in reality. And I think it will be, I don't know when, but by the end of 2004, when we are no more conducting investigation, we must find a solution how to publish the facts, the what happened, because it is important for the element of reconciliation. And of course, it's Begovic, Tudjman, we cannot pursue, or we cannot issue the indictment, but we collect a lot of facts, so it must be a possibility. I don't know if the commission, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, or other form, but it will be important. Yes, I agree with you. It's to be done. We'll try to find a solution how to publish that. Yes.
Okay, the gentleman down here.
Take the microphone. I'm Paul Totko, architect in London. Would Madame de la Ponte like to comment on the indictment of General Gotovina?
Yes.
For the alleged murders of two individuals, Bosiljka Beric and Mirjana Beric, who have now arisen from the dead in Serbia and Bosnia, respectively. According to the letter dated 9th of October 03, addressed to the General Secretary Kofi Annan by Gotovina's defense lawyer, Luka Mišetić. Thank you.
Yes, what is the question? What is the question?
Would you comment?
You want a comment?
Yes.
Yes, it's a fact who is perfectly known by us. You know, sometimes it appears that, you know, the identification of the victims are an extremely laborious work, because thousands and thousands of bodies, mass graves, exhumation, DNA, it is incredible. And of course, we cannot identify all. We identify only part of them. And sometimes we incur in error, also because we have not an anagraph. We have not, it's not like in a because it was conflict, it was war. So they distract the documentation with another. So in the Gotovina indictment, we have two victims that after months, it came out that they are not victim, but they are alive. Yes, it's not the first time. And I would say we have thousands of victims who are not identified, unfortunately. But what I want to tell you, when I saw that, normally we amend the indictment immediately. But it was in summer. But because it was said that Gotovina with voluntary surrender, and because we have other counts to add to the Gotovina indictment, and that is a scoop for you and for all. I told to my people, wait to do that, because we do all together. Because, you know, amendment and indictment each time, it's a work. And we were expecting voluntary surrender of Gotovina. So we amended the indictment just once. We take out the two victims, we put other victims we identify, and other counts. But in the meantime, we decided not to voluntary surrender. So we will do that. We will amend this indictment next week, and so we are still expecting Gotovina to come.
Thank you.
Okay, I will take one last question, and I'm going to take that lady in the middle there.
Yes,
you.
My name is Regina. I'm from the United States.
Yes.
I wanted to ask about the Rwanda example of Victor's justice, because when you were prosecutor there, I understood that you mentioned the possibility of indicting and trying RPF members, and that
yes.
has not to date happened, and I wanted to know your thoughts on that, and particularly its implications for reconstructing the divided community there.
Yes. You know, I must say, we get a lot of evidences against the Tutsi army, RPF. Even if we were not looking for at the beginning, because we have a genocide, it was a big genocide. So many responsible from this genocide, 500,000 victims or even more. But during our investigation, it come out that also the other party have committed massacres, and we identify 13 sites of massacres. So, you know, you cannot just say, ah, no, we don't look at that because now. So at one moment, when we collect enough elements, we open this investigation. But, you know, I didn't want to do it without the knowledge of the Rwanda government. Of course not. So I went to the authorities and I said, I have here this massacre, that is your military have done it, so we open investigation. And at the beginning, they promised to give us cooperation, but they didn't cooperate never cooperate with us. Last year, they start to obstruct our trials, and they suspend our witnesses are coming from Rwanda, so they must be allowed to come out, immigration law, and. And they suspend that, so they must suspend, we suspend our our trials because we didn't receive witnesses. President and I went to the Security Council, formally complained. After the Rwanda start again, but of course they don't want that we conduct this investigation. President Kagame was very angry about me and told me, you must not open this investigation. You do what the priority is, genocide. Do the investigation of genocide and stop this investigation. And I said, no, I think I'm an independent prosecutor. And I think it is also my duty to, under the mandate of the Security Council, that we conduct this investigation. And at the end, I'm no more prosecutor of ICTR.
Well, thank
but you. I hope that my successor, and I spoke with him, I hope that my successor will continue and issue the indictment, yes.
Well, thank you, and I'm really sorry to all the many people who had questions. This was a great discussion, and I'm really grateful to Carlo Del Ponte for answering all some very difficult questions in an extremely frank way. And let's thank her again. And then if you like.
Thank you very much, and I will invite you all to come to The Hague, to the Tribune ICTY, and to be in the public gallery in the Milosevic trial, please.